Howdy, listeners. KJ here, as you probably know, to tell you that if you're not listening to the Writing the Book episodes Jenny Nash and I have been doing, you should be. Jenny's working on her latest nonfiction, and I'm working on my next novel, and we're both trying to do something bigger and better than anything we've done before. We sit down weekly and dish about everything from Jenny's proposal and the process of getting an agent to my extremely circular method of creating a story. We are brutally honest and open, even beyond what we are here. Truly, we probably say way too much. And for that reason, Writing the Books is subscriber only. So I'm here saying subscribe. That's a whole nother episode a week, and always a juicy one. Plus, there's all the other good subscriber stuff, the First Page Book Lab, Jess's From Author to Authority series, and whatever else we come up with, which kind of varies enough that it's hard to list out. Plus, of course, access to whenever we run the blueprint, which, I don't know, it's going to be soon. That's all I got. So head to amwritingpodcast.com, get yourself signed up, and come listen to Writing the Book, and then talk to us. Tell us about your book writing and what's going on. We really want to hear from y'all. Thanks a lot, and please subscribe.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, it's Jess Leahy, and welcome to the hashtag Am Writing Podcast. This is a podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, poetry, proposals, queries, nonfiction, fiction, all the stuff. In the end, this is the podcast about getting the work done. And in the beginning of this podcast, our goal was to flatten the learning curve for other writers. So I am super excited about who I have today. Quick intro. I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation. And you can find my work at The New York Times, The Atlantic, and The Washington Post. As you can find the work of my guest there, too. My guest today is someone that I have looked up to for a long time and someone I use as sort of to bounce things off of and to think about how I do my work and how to do my work better. Jeff Salingo, thank you so much for coming on the show. Jeff is the author of a couple of books that I'm a huge, in fact, I can look over at my bookshelf right now and see all of his books on getting into college, why college is not the end point. He has a new book coming out that we're going to be talking about. It's coming out as soon as this podcast comes out. And I'm a huge fan, Jeff. Thank you so, so much for coming on the pod.
Just the same here. And I'm a huge fan of this podcast as well. It's on my regular rotation. So I'm thrilled, as always, to be here.
It's changed over the years, and now that we have four different co-hosts, there's sort of a different takes on it. We've got like Serena the business side, and Jess the nonfiction geek side, and KJ the fiction side, and Jenny the nuts and bolts editor side. So it's been really fun for us to sort of split off. But what I wanted to talk to you about today are a couple of different things. Your book, Who Gets In and Why, is on the podcast, we talk about dissecting other people's work as a way. In fact, I was talking to my daughter about this yesterday. She's writing a thesis, what she hopes will be one chapter in a book. And I was saying, one of the things you can do is go dissect other books you think are really well constructed, books who are reaching the same, a similar audience. And your book, Who Gets In and Why, I think is essential reading for anyone who's writing interview-based and specifically nonfiction around attempting to get their arms around a process, and a process that for you, what I'm really interested about in this book is a process that's usually, guarded and kind of secret, and no one wants to let you in for real on all the moving parts and how the decisions are made, because the college admissions process is, it's an inexact recipe. It depends on where you are. It depends on the school. But everyone wants the secret. Like, Jeff, just get me the secrets of how to get in. So how do you approach people who are in a sense, some ways, secret keepers and guardians of the secret sauce, to mix metaphors. How do you get those people to agree to be a part of a book, not just to be interviewed, but to actually put themselves out there and to put the sausage making out there in a book, which can be a huge leap of faith for any organization or human being.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely harder now than it was when I did Who Gets In and Why. I think it's harder than when, other people have been inside the process, whether it's, Fast Food Nation, with the fast food industry, which is a book that I looked up to, when I was writing Who Gets In and Why. I think it's people just don't trust writers and journalists as much as they used to. So I think that's a lot of this is really trust. First of all, you have to approach organizations that trust their own process. When people ask me, why did these three schools, I approached 24 schools when I wrote Who Gets In and Why, and three said yes, 21 said no. And when I described the people who said yes and why they said yes, they trusted their own process and they also trusted me. But the first thing they did was trust their own process. And so when I heard later on from people who had said no to me, and I would, talk to them, off the record about why they said no, there was always something about their process, their admissions process, that they didn't trust. They were getting a new like software system, or they had new employees that they didn't really quite know, or they were doing things. It's not that they were doing things wrong, but that, it was at the time when the Supreme Court was making a decision about affirmative action, and they didn't quite know how that would play, and so they didn't quite trust it, and then how that obviously would be used by me. So the first thing you have to do is think about organizations that really believe in themselves, because they're going to be the ones that are going to talk about themselves externally. And then you just have to build trust with between them and you. And that just takes, unfortunately, it takes time. And as a book author or a reporter, you don't always have that on your side.
So when were some of these cold in, like of the 24, were all of these cold? Were some of these colder? Did you have an in with some of these already?
I had an in with most of them because I had been, I mean, that's the other thing, trust is built over time. And I had been covering higher ed for almost 25 years now. So it was just that they knew me, they knew of me, they knew of my work. I had other people vouch for me. I had worked with other people in other admissions offices on other stories, and they knew people in some of these offices, so they would vouch for me. But at the end, it ended up being Emory, Davidson, and the University of Washington. It was really only Davidson where I knew somebody. Emory and University of Washington, I kind of knew people there that were the initial door opener, but beyond that, it was just spending time with them and helping them understand why I wanted to tell this story, how I thought the story would play out, and getting them to just trust the process.
There's also something to be said for people who have some enthusiasm for the greater story to be told, especially people who have an agenda. If whether that's opening up admissions to the quote the whole student as opposed to just their test scores, or someone who feels like they really have something to add to the story. Both of the people who I featured in the addiction inoculation and who insisted on having their real names used said, there's a value for me in putting this story out there and finding worth in it. Even though for these two people, there was some risk and there was embarrassment and there's, this shame around substance use disorder. But these two people said, I just think there's a bigger story to be told and I'm really proud to be a part of that bigger story. So there is a selling aspect also to, how you position what it is you're doing.
And there's a little bit of that, and that was certainly true here. The admissions deans at these places were longtime leaders who not only trusted their own process, but understood that the industry was getting battered. People were not trusting of admissions. They felt like it was a game to be played, and there was definitely a larger story that they wanted to tell there. Now, truth be told, and they've told this in conferences that I've been at and on panels that I've moderated with them. There was also a little bit of they wanted to get their own story out, meaning the institution story, right? Emory is, competing against Vanderbilt, and Davidson is a liberal arts college in the South when most liberal arts colleges are in the Northeast. So there was a little bit of, hey, if we participate in this, people are going to get to know us in a different way, and that is going to help us at the end, meaning the institution.
Do you have to, did you, was there a hurdle of, we really have, you know, this is some PR for us too. So did that affect, I mean, there's a little bit of a Heisenberg thing going on here. What did the fact that you were observing them change, you think, anything about what they did and what they showed you?
It's an interesting thing because, Jess, it's a great question because I often get that because I was, you know, originally I wanted to do one office. I wanted to be inside one institution. And when all three of them kind of came back and said, yes, we'll do this, instead of just choosing one of them, I thought, oh, this is interesting. We have a small liberal arts college. We have a big private, you know, urban research university. We have a big public university in the University of Washington. So I wanted to show kind of compare and contrast their processes. But that also meant I couldn't be in one place all the time. There's only one of me, and there's three of them, and they're in different parts of the country. So clearly, I was not there every day during the process. And
Right.
somebody would say to me, oh, well, how do you know they're not going to do X, Y, and Z when you're not there? And I quickly realized that they had so much work to do in such a short amount of time that they couldn't really game the system for me. After a while, I just became like a painting on the wall. I just was there, and in many cases, they didn't even notice I was there, which, by the way, is where you want to be because they would say things, do things without realizing sometimes that a reporter was present. And there's the opening scene of the book, which is just a fantastic, in my opinion, one of my favorite scenes of the book, right? Where they're talking about these students and so forth, and in a way that is so raw and so natural about how they did their work. If they knew I was in the room at that point, which of course they did, but if they really perceived my being there, that would have been really hard to pull off.
Did you guys have an agreement about off the record moments or anything like that? Or was there a, and speaking of which, actually, was there any kind of contract going into this or any kind of agreement going into this?
I basically told them that there would be no surprises. So everything was essentially on the record unless they explicitly said that. And that was usually during interviews, like one-on-one interviews. But while I was in the room with them, there was really nothing off the record. There couldn't be because it was hard to like kind of stop what they were doing to do that. The only thing I promised was that there would be no surprises at the end. So when the book was done during the fact-checking process, I would do what the New Yorker would do during fact-checking. I wouldn't read the passages back to them, but I would tell them basically what's in there in terms of it as I fact-checked it. And so they really kind of knew for the most part, not word for word, but they kind of knew what was in the book before it came out.
I like that term, no surprises. It's a real nice blanket statement for, look, I'm not looking to, there's no gotcha
No,
things
gotcha.
here. Right,
Exactly. Right.
exactly.
This
This is
was
not
not an
gotcha journalism.
investigative piece, but there were things that, you know, I'm sure that they would have preferred not to be in there. But for the most part, during the fact-checking process, you know, I learned things that were helpful. You know, sometimes they would say, oh, that's an interesting way of, you know, I would redirect quotes and they would want to change them. And I said, well, I don't really want to change direct quotes because that's what was said in that moment. And then they would provide context for things, which was sometimes helpful. I would add that to the piece or I would add that to the book. So at the end of the day, again, it goes back to trust. And they realized what I was trying to do with this book. It's also a book rather than an article. Books tend to have permanence. And I knew that this book would have, you know, shelf life. And as a result, I wanted to make sure that it would stand the test of time.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about your new book, your book that's just coming out as this is getting out into the world called Dream School. And by the way, such a great title, because one person's dream school is not another, but like my daughter happens to be at, I think, the perfect school for her. And my son went to the perfect school for him, which by the way, wasn't even his first choice. And in retrospect, he said, I'm just so glad I didn't get into that other place, my, you know, early decision place, because this other place really was the perfect match. And I think that's why I love that title so much, because I spend a lot of time trying to help parents understand that their dream may not necessarily be their child's dream. And what makes something a dream school may, you know, in fact, in terms of time, my daughter was applying to colleges just coming out of COVID. Like she had never been to a school dance. She'd never, you know, all that kind of stuff. So for me, the dream looked very different than maybe it would have 4 years prior, thinking I was going to have a kid that had the opportunity to sort of socially, you know, integrate into the world in a very different way. So I love that. And is that something that, how do your ideas emerge? Did it emerge, in the form of that idea of what is a dream school for someone? Or anyway, I'll let you get that.
Like many follow-up books, this book emerged from discussing who gets in and why. So I was out on the road talking about who gets in and why, and I would have a number of parents, like, you know, when you give talks, people come up to you afterwards and they say, okay, we love this book, but there's always a but. And people would come up to me about who gets in and why, and they would be like, love the book, but it focused more on selective colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. What if we don't get into one of those places? What if we can't afford one of those places? What if we don't really want to play that game? Mm-hmm. And we want permission. And this idea of a permission structure came up very early on in the reporting for this book. We need to be able to tell our friends, our family, that it's okay, right? You know how it is, right? A lot of this is about parents wanting to say that their kid goes to Harvard. It's less about going to Harvard, but they could tell their friends that their kid goes to Harvard. So they wanted me to help them create this permission structure to be able to look more widely at schools. That's how this came about. And then the idea of dream school, and I'm fascinated by your reaction to that title, because the reaction I've been getting from some people is, you know, because the idea to many people, the idea of a dream school is a single entity.
Of course.
A single school, it's a single type of school. And what really, it's a play on that term that we talk about, a dream school. In many ways, the dream school is your dream and what you want and the best fit for you. And I want to give you the tools in this book to try to figure out what is the best match for you that fulfills your dreams. It's kind of a little play on that, a little tweak on how we think about the dream and dream school. And that's really what I'm hoping to do for this book, is that in some ways it's a follow-up. So you read Who Gets In and Why, you decide, okay, maybe I do want to try for those highly selected places. But as I tell the story early on in dream school, it's almost impossible to get into most of those places today, even more so than 5 or 6 years ago. And second, many of the students that I met, young adults that I met in reporting dream school, ended up at, you know, fill in the blank, most popular school, brand name school, highly selective school, elite school, whatever you want to put in that blank. And it wasn't quite what they expected. And so that's another story that I want to tell families in this book, is that, hey, there's a wider world out there, and there is success to be had at many of these places.
There's something I say occasionally that I have to take the temperature of the room, because I, you know, you and I speak at some fairly similar places, like, you know, the hoity-toity private schools that, you know, everyone's just go, 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 do, 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 achieve, achieve, achieve. And every once in a while, I like to, number one, tell them that my college was, I think, perfect for me. I went to my safety school. I went to the University of Massachusetts and had an extraordinary experience. But I'm a very certain kind of person, and maybe for another, like, for example, my daughter, when we were looking at schools, our state school was just too big for her. It just, she was going to get lost. It wasn't going to work very well. But the thing I like to say when I feel like the audience is ready to hear it is, what if it's a massive relief if you don't have an Ivy kid? If you have a kid who's not going to get into an Ivy school, isn't it a relief to say, that's not what we're aiming for here, and we can actually find a place that's a great fit for my kid? And that sometimes goes over really well. For a few people, they'll come up and thank me for that sort of reframing afterwards. But for some people, that is just not at all what they want to hear.
And it's, you know, it's really hard. And I think you go back to audience, and, you know, most people make money on books kind of after the fact, right? The speaking, as you mentioned, and things like that. And it's interesting, this book, as I talk to counselors about it, high school counselors, oh, they're like, this is perfect. This is the message I've been trying to get through to parents. Then I talk to the parents, and they're like, I'm not quite sure this message will work in our community, because this community is very focused on getting into, you know, the Ivy League and the Ivy Pluses.
Yes, but that's why your title is so brilliant, because if you're getting, and I talk a lot about this, I don't know if you've heard, I've talked about this on the podcast, that with the substance use prevention stuff, it's hard for me to get people to come in.
Right,
so
exactly.
I use Gift of Failure to do
to
that.
To kind of pull them in. Right.
So you've got this title that can get the people in the seats, and then you, in your persuasive and charismatic way, can explain to them why this is a term that may could use some expanding. I think that's an incredible opportunity.
And it's important to, early on, my editor told me, Jeff, don't forget we're an aspirational society. And I said, I'm not telling people not to apply in the Ivy League. I'm not saying they're terrible schools. I'm not saying don't look at those places. All I'm saying is we want to expand our field a little bit to look more broadly, more widely. So we're not saying don't do this, mm-hmm. but we're saying do this. And that's what I'm hoping that this book does.
Well, and the reality is people listen to the title. They don't read the subtitle because subtitles are long and they have a great use, but not when you're actually talking about a book with someone. And so what they're going to hear is Dream School. So, and I think that's a fantastic way to position the book. But since you opened up the topic, I am right now mentoring someone who is attempting to sell a book while also planning for a speaking career, which, as you know, is something that I did concurrently. How did you know you wanted to do speaking when you were first writing your books, or is this something that sort of came out of the books themselves?
It's came out of the books. You know, the first book, which was College Unbound, which was 2012, mm-hmm. Sold better than I expected, but it was aimed at a consumer audience. Who ended up reading that were college leaders, presidents, mm-hmm. And people who work at colleges. So I had a very busy schedule speaking to people inside the industry. Mm-hmm. Then I turned my, the second book, There Is Life After College, really turned it to this parenting audience, which was a very new audience to me. And that really led to me to, who gets in and why, and now this book. The difference, and I'm always curious to talk to parenting authors like you, is that college, people, even the most aspirational people in life, I understand, people in certain cities think about preschool, what preschool their kids are going to go to get into the right college. But in reality, they're going to read a college book when their kids are in high school. Mm-hmm. And that is the more challenging piece around, unlike most parenting authors who have a wider audience, because a lot of the issues that face parents when they have toddlers, when they have preteens, when they have teens, obviously some parenting authors just focus on teens. I get that. But this book really has kind of a short life, mm-hmm. in terms of the audience. And so what we're trying to do, so think about it, who gets in and why? It's still in hardcover, has never mm-hmm. been published in paperback, largely because there's a new audience for it every year, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. That is the massive upside. And for me, it's usually a 4-year sort of turnover in terms of speaking anyway.
Yeah. You're right. And so the nice thing on the speaking front is that I have almost a new audience every year. So I could continue to go back to the same schools every year, which has been really helpful with a slightly different message because the industry is also changing and, mm-hmm. and admissions is changing as a result. So no, the speaking came afterwards and now realize that that's really kind of how you make this thing work. I couldn't really have a writing career without the speaking piece.
Since figuring that out, and I guess assuming that you enjoy doing it, as I hope you do, is that something that you're continuing to market on your own?
Yes. So that's what we're doing. One of the big changes from the last book is that we have developed we built a customer relation management system mm-hmm. under our newsletter.
Nice.
So we use HubSpot, which is like Salesforce. It's something mm-hmm. like that. And so we've now built a community that is much stronger than the one that I had 5 years ago. That mm-hmm. That's a community of parents, of counselors, of independent counselors. So we just know so much more about who we serve, who our readers mm-hmm. are, and who will ask me to come speak to their groups and things like that. So that to me has been the biggest change since the last book compared to this book. And it has enabled us, and it's something that I would highly encourage authors to do. I don't think they have to go out and buy one of these big robust systems, but the more you know about your readers mm-hmm. and build that community, the more that they're going to respond to you. They mm-hmm. really want to be with you in some way. They want to read your books. They want to come to your webinars. They want to listen to your podcasts. They want to see you speak. They want to invite you to speak. And building that community is incredibly important to having that career mm-hmm. After the book comes out.
It's also for marketing purposes. So Serena Bowen, again, brilliant at this. The way she does that is she slices and dices her mailing list into all kinds of, like, where the reader came from. Is this someone who's, more interested in this? Did I meet them at this conference? You know, how did I acquire this name for my list? And she does a lot of marketing very specifically to those specific lists. And that information is amazing. And I think so many of us tend to think just, and I have to admit that this is where I spend most of my time, is just getting more emails in your newsletter, owning, you know, the right, because it's an honor of being able to reach out to those people and have them be interested in what you have to say. But that's your, I may have to have you come back at some point to talk specifically about that, because it's increasingly, as we're doing more of the marketing for our books, I think that's the future for people who want to keep things going.
And that's, you know, that is the reality today, is that's why proposals sell, because people, you know, publishers really want people with platforms. And if you're not a superstar, and there's very few of those out there, you need to figure out another way to build that platform. And so in marketing yourself is critically important. And I've learned that from book one. You know, people would say, well, you're always just selling your book. And I said, well, if I don't sell it, no one else is going to sell it. Right. So at some point, the publisher, you know, there's only so much the publisher is going to do, and they don't really have the tools that you do. And more than that, Jess, like, you understand your audience. Serena understands her audience, right? Like, these, we understand our audiences in ways that publishers who are doing, you know, dozens and dozens of books a year just don't get.
Right.
No, and absolutely. No offense against them. I mean, they're doing really good work, but it's just, it's hard for them, I think, to really understand, well, who's going to really read this book?
And I love the idea of using the questions you get as, I tend to take the questions that I get and turn them into videos, and I do answer all the emails, and I keep a spreadsheet of what those questions are so that I can slice and dice it in various ways. And they're fascinating. And that shapes, like, oh, wow, I had no idea so many people, like, I had no idea that so many kids were actually interested in knowing whether or not the caffeine, amounts of caffeine that they're drinking are healthy, or how to get better sleep. Because if you ask their parents, they're like, oh no, they don't care about sleep, or they just drink so much coffee and they don't care. And yet what you hear from the kids is such a different story. And the thing that I also love is the idea of, you know, what that dream school concept means to the actual kid applying. You've probably heard this before, but I needed some symbolic way to let my kids know that this was not, in the end, my decision, and how important this decision was for them in terms of becoming adults. And so that I said, the one thing I will never do is put a sticker for a school on the back of my car, because your choice of where to become a young emerging adult is not, I don't, that's not my currency to brag on as a parent. It's too important for that. And so people go nuts over that. They're like, but that's what I really want, is that sticker on the back of the car. And so I have to be careful when I talk about it. But for my kids, that was my one symbolic act to say, this is about your growth and development and not my bragging rights. And I think that's a hard message.
I think that's really important, especially, I have two teens at home. And I think this is a whole topic for another conversation around, you know, most parenting authors are also parents at the same time that they're doling this advice out to everybody else. And I'm very aware of that. I'm also very aware of the privacy that they deserve. And so it's a fine line. It's a hard line to walk, I will say, for authors, because people, they want to know you and they ask you a lot of questions, like, especially around college, like, well, where are your kids applying? Where are they going to go? Like, oh, I bet you, especially this book where I'm encouraging parents to think more broadly, well, you're probably giving that advice to everybody else, but you're not going to follow that, surely, right? It's hard when you're in this world that you're also part of every day.
It's really tough. And things have gotten a lot more complicated, as listeners know. I have a trans kid, and that means that everything that I've ever written about that kid is out there. Some of it changeable, a lot of it, most of it not. And would I do it again? I don't think so. And that, you know, that's been a journey, but it's also been You know, we can't know what we don't know. I don't know. It's a tough one, but I really admire your. That's why I throw my safety school thing out there all the time. I'm like, look, you know, I went to the place that saved my parents a boatload of money and allowed me to do stuff like traveling that I never would have had the ability to do if I hadn't gone to my state school. And my priorities were big and adventures and lots of options. And I'm very, very clear that standing up for myself was something that I wanted to learn how to do more. On the other hand, that's not been the priority for both of my kids. So. I want to ask one quick college question, just because it's in reading all of your books, this comes up for me over and over again. How do you help parents see the difference between their dream and their kid's dream, or their goals and their kid's goals? And how do you dance that line, which I think is a very easy place to lose readers, lose listeners, because they just shut down and they say, that's not something I want to mess with. This is too important to me.
It's a fine line. It's a difficult line to walk. At some point, I have to realize who's the you that you're speaking to. And mm-hmm. I even say this in the introduction of the new book. It's largely parents. They're the readers. Mm-hmm. I know that. I hope their kids will read it. Maybe. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll read it as a family. But I'm really speaking to the families. And I want them to understand that college especially is an emotional good. It's something many of us, you're talking about your undergraduate experience. I'm not going to ask you how long ago that was, but my undergraduate experience.
I'm 55,
was also,
right, so it's been a long time.
And I'm 52, right? So same year. But we have this, you know, most people, because of the audiences I tend to speak to, they're not first generation students, right? They're mostly, mm-hmm. Most of the parents in the audience went to college themselves. And for many of them, it was a transformative experience, mm-hmm. like it was for me. People met their lifelong friends. They met their partners. They decided what they wanted to do in life. It was this experience we all think it is. And as a result, I think that a lot of parents put that then on their kids. Well, this mm-hmm. was a transformative experience for me, so right. It definitely has to be a transformative experience for you. Oh, and by the way, these are all the mistakes I made in doing that. I want to make sure you don't make any of those
mistakes. And by the way, no pressure, but this is where you're going to meet your best friends, your spouse. It's the best years of your life, so don't sacrifice even a second of it.
Yeah,
no
and
pressure.
No pressure. And not only that, but it is something we bought a very long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm always amazed when sometimes we go to the Jersey Shore on vacation, and I'll be out on a walk on the beach in the morning, and I'll see people wearing, you know, college shirts, sweatshirts. And, you know, some of these people are old, much older than I am. And I say, oh, you know, we'll start to have a conversation. And I'll say, oh, does your grandkid, you know, go to X school? Terrible assumption on my part, I know. but they said, no, that's where I went. And it's amazing to me. These are people in their 70s and 80s, because I'm the only other person out that early walking. And they love this thing so much that they're still kind of advertising
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was so different back then. And that's the thing mm-hmm. that I, going back to your question, that's the thing I try to explain to parents. You could guide this. You could put guardrails up. You might have to put guardrails up about money and location and all mm-hmm. that other stuff. But college has changed so much that don't try to make this your search. You had your chance. You did your search. It worked out. It didn't work out. You would have done things differently. I think that's all great advice to give to your kids. But this is their life. This is their staging ground. They have to learn. And again, it's also different. Like, part of what I hope my books do is to try to explain to people that who, you know, kind of dip in and dip out of higher ed just when their kids are applying, that it's very different than when they applied and went to college.
The thing I like to mention a lot is that people in admissions read so many applications that they can tell when something is sincere and something is personal and smacks of a kid, as opposed to when something smacks of a parent. That is a very different application. It's a very different essay, which is the thing that I guess I have the most experience with. But so I am just so incredibly grateful to you for this book. I'm so grateful that there's evidence that people will actually agree to be interviewed, even in thorny situations like college admissions, which I don't know. I'm still in awe of the fact that you got anyone to say yes. I heartily recommend Dream School to anyone who's listening. I just I don't even have anyone applying to college. And I think it's just a fascinating topic because the idea of where we become, who we're going to be, and how we prime lots of other stuff that's going to happen later on in our life. I think that's a fascinating topic. So thank you so much for writing about it. Thank you for writing about it with such empathy and such interest. That's the other thing, is you can tell when someone really is interested in a topic when they read their book. And thank you for providing a book that I recommend all the time as a blueprint, as a dissection book for people writing nonfiction, heavily interviewed nonfiction. So thank you so much. Where can people find you if they want you to come speak, if they want to find your books? Where can people find you?
Pretty simple. JeffSalingo.com is my website. And you could also follow me on most social media. Handle is at JSalingo, as in Jeff. And just love hearing from readers. As you know, that is, books change lives. And I love hearing the stories when readers tell me they read something in a book and they acted on it. It's just the most beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's the best. I get videos occasionally, too, of like little kids doing things their parents didn't think they could do. And look, they did this thing. It's just, it's an amazing and place of privilege. You have a newsletter also.
I do, called Next. It comes out twice a month.
It's fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's fantastic.
And I have a podcast also called Future You that's more around the kind of the insidery nature of higher ed and how it works. But I know a lot of families listen to it to try to understand this black box that is college. So that's called Future You, as you in university.
The reason I love the podcast so much is it's a lot of what parents get exposed to when they're doing the college admissions process are those graphs, scatter graphs of like, where do your numbers intersect with the expectations of this school? And it's a real human version of that. It's a human version of how that black box operates.
And it's at the end of the day, as I always remind parents, it's a business. You might have this emotional tie to college, but if you don't, and you know, a mutual friend of ours, Ron Lieber, who writes for the New York Times around college finances, right? He always reminds people of this too. I don't remind him as often as he does, and I probably should. You're buying a consumer product and you have to act as a consumer. Yes, you could have an emotional tie and a love for this place, but this is a big purchase and you have to approach it like that.
Did you see his most recent piece about taking some time and seeing what kind of offers you can get? I loved it. I love Ron's approach to he's just a great guy and his books are fantastic. Thank you again so much. I'm going to let you get on with your day, but I'm always grateful for you and good luck with the launch of Dream School. I will be out applauding on Pub Day for you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Jess.
All right, everyone. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.